You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Margaret's like, tōku ingoa nau mai, haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora everyone, welcome to the Thursday Wire for the 30th of January. Shit, I can't believe January's over, eh?
Yeah, that went really, really fast.
I know.
One of those people that doesn't like to think that time's flying by, but yeah.
I think it's because I've just been like duffing the summer away, you know?
Yeah, I've seen you duffing. You've got a lot of duff in you.
Must be that I'm 20. I'm your host, Mary Margaret Slack. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also with Sam. Him and I have been having a lot of nightmares this week. We were talking about that this morning.
Yeah, like it's a thing. Like I've talked to 4 people in the last like 24 hours that have been having nightmares.
Something in the air.
What was your nightmare about?
Oh my God. Okay. To be fair, I just want to say like I do usually get much worse nightmares than this. But recently I purchased a new shampoo online and I had a dream that when they arrived, they weren't in glass bottles. They were in plastic bottles. So that's...
World's burning out there, guys. Oh, world's bro. Burning.
I really wish I hadn't said that on air. Coming up on the show today, we speak to Andrew Little for the first time this year about his visions for 2020 and the election. And we speak about recent developments at the UN regarding New Zealand's justice system and climate change refugees around the world and particularly in the Pacific. Sam speaks to David Robertson from Gen Zero regarding their disappointment with the government underfunding green transport infrastructure. Neighbourhood Watch with Radio Adelaide Zoe Canandis about Invasion Day and coronavirus and how it's affecting certain Australians and how ScoMo's dealing with it. Spoiler alert, he's being silly again. And finally, Sam chats to Professor Elaine Rush from AUT about how our economies on focus on food exports affect the poorest New Zealanders. Tukupatuhi mai, get in touch, text us on 5395 or YMI, give us a call on 309 3879. Let us know your thoughts.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Yes, indeedy. We're just going to get straight into it. It was our first time chatting this year, so it was very good to hear from him. Happy New Year. It's good to talk to you.
You too. Yeah. Feels like the year's sort of well underway already.
I know. It happens so fast, doesn't it?
Sure does.
So let's start generally about how you're feeling about 2020. What's your sort of feelings at this point going ahead to the election now that the date's been announced?
Yeah, I think it gives everybody something to focus on now. We have a pretty clear target. But from my point of view as part of government, as a minister in a government, that is really starting to tackle with some of the pretty big problems that we've got. And knowing it takes time to make significant change, I'm really pleased with where we're at. I'm really pleased with the issues that, as a government, we've identified ourselves with. I'm pleased that as a genuinely MMP coalition government, we've held together really well. And I think what's different in the last 2.5 years compared to previous coalition governments is that the smaller parties, their support has held up right throughout. And I think it shows that, you know, there was give and take. There's a lot of negotiation. And I think that's what New Zealanders wanted out of MMP. So, look, from my point of view, we go into 2020. You never get complacent or arrogant about it. But I think we in part have a degree of confidence that we've made a good start in addressing some really serious problems.
Mm. Some speculation is given that there's been some holdback for you to do the full extent of change and reform that was necessary. If you got in on a second term, do you think that your government would sort of accelerate that change that needs to happen?
Well, I mean, look, the nature of politics is that, you know, when as governments form, each one is different. And you do what you can with the arrangements that you've got. So, you know, we've got in this government, obviously the Labor Party is the centrepiece to it, and we have New Zealand First and the Green Party, both occupy different parts of the political spectrum. But the way government is managed is everybody's got to be kept in the tent, and that means there's a lot of give and take. So I think the days of promising that, yep, we're going to have kind of radical change very quickly you know, the reason why New Zealanders voted for MEP in 1993 is that they didn't want that. They wanted transparency and negotiation. They wanted change to be at a pace that, that you know, was humanly possible. So that, that is the nature of government in New Zealand. That said, you know, we've made some pretty big commitments about dealing with some pretty big and important issues. Climate change, you know, foremost amongst them. But actually, you know, things like what we're doing in health, what we're doing in education. The sort of work that Chris Hipkins is doing in education has been phenomenal. It's all along foundations at this point because, actually, the payback, we won't see for another 7 or 8 years. In the criminal justice area, we're making a start. But you know, we know that criminal justice is a hot-button issue for particularly the right-wingers, and National has made it pretty clear. They want that to become an election issue. So we'll manage that carefully. But I think most New Zealanders know that things in that area need to change because we're just not doing very well. But people want to know that as we make change, community safety is the top priority, and that's the way we're approaching it. And I think there will be change, but it will be a New Zealand style of change at a pace that people can live with.
Mm. From my perspective, it's pretty impossible for us to have change without voters fully understanding what, you know, you referenced 1993 being, you know, significant change. But do we have sufficient civics education for everyone to partake in that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think, you know, certainly in Labor, we always say, look, we need to do better. In that civics education, I think we're very keen to see something rolled out, at least for those, you know, at school age sort of thing.
Mm. Will that be a policy this year?
Look, I think it is party policy, whether it's on the manifesto or all that, those decisions are yet to be taken. But I think what's going to be really interesting in this election is what happens with the two referendum questions and how the debate around that gets conducted. Yes, obviously there's some information that the government will put out as government, but it won't be necessarily the advocacy of the issues. It'll be up to the advocacy groups in the community to come out and do their stuff. And look, I think there are two issues too that also will become beacons for those who want to mislead and misrepresent and kind of manipulate, and we've got to be alert to that. But I think, you know, it'll be an interesting test and to make sure that people can get access to good information and be well informed before they get to make their decisions on either of those referendum questions.
Yeah, most definitely. One of those referendum questions being obviously legalisation of cannabis. For me, I see that issue as extremely holistic in terms of our broken justice system, which you obviously were just in Geneva and spoke to the United Nations Human Rights Council about the fact that our justice system is broken. Do you want to touch on that experience a little bit for us?
Yeah, we routinely report to the various UN bodies, but that was, in a country like ours, and a treaty-based sort of country, and 15 to 16% of the population are Māori, but over 50% of our prison population, and in fact for women, over 60% of women in our prison are Māori. That tells you that there's something seriously wrong. And then when you have a look at things, you know, across all prisoners, reoffending rates and all the rest of it. And we had the report out yesterday saying high proportion of prisoners have head injuries or other cognitive issues going on. And all we do is lock them up and wonder why they, you know, they're not all making kind of rational decisions about how they live their lives. Well, of course they're not. And we're doing the wrong things if we want to change the people for the better and reduce offending. So that's, you know, and with the likes of Kelvin Davis, as Corrections Minister, Stuart Nash, as Minister of Police, we all totally line up on saying we've got to approach this differently. And in fairness to the Commissioner of Police, the current one, he has started a program about frontline policing, taking a different view about dealing with, you know, people who, you know, whether they're unwell or otherwise troubled, just, you know, arresting and throwing in a cell overnight is not the future, and we've got to change that outlook. So we're in the process of doing that. When it comes to the cannabis stuff, look, I think, you know, there's an issue there too about how cannabis is policed now. I think the question in the referendum will be, knowing that this is a substance that can cause harm but equally can be consumed safely, is, you know, what do New Zealanders want? How do we want to do this? Do we want to say, look, we actually think we can regulate and control this in a way that we can minimise the harm and those who are using it safely continue to do so? Or do we just think the risks are too great? And that's going to be the the choice that people are going to have to make.
Yeah. Obviously, the recommendations that come out of the Human Rights Council are not binding. I just wanted to raise, when I was in second year of anthropology, I learned about Foucault theory and how one of the quickest evolutions was changing from public torture to private imprisonment. And the concept was, you know, you lock someone up so you don't have to touch them, but you attack their soul. Yeah. If our justice system is broken, did prisons go wrong, or is its conception itself problematic and grounds for abolition?
I think there are people for whom prison is the best place. They're violent. They do know what they're doing. They're pathological. They're sociopaths. And actually, that's the best place for them. You know, you try transformation and all the rest of it. But the reality is, the vast majority of people who wind up in prison have a whole heap of other things going on. And it's usually, it is cognitive issues early in life. They've been beaten up at home, or they've been subject to violence, they've observed violence in the home, or they've got other genetic issues that means their brain hasn't developed. They drop out of school. They survive in whatever way they can. They end up engaging in criminal activity. When you look at, you know, those who engage in criminal activity in the gangs, young folks who are looking for a sense of identity, looking for economic security, they get it from the gang. So they get engaged in criminal activity. Now, we can actually do something about those people. The sociopaths and the people who are kind of pathologically just nasty and not very nice, there's probably not a great deal we can do except containment. But for the vast majority, there's better stuff we can do and we should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish on the ruling of the United Nations that governments cannot return people to countries where their lives might be threatened by climate change. The ruling acknowledges a legal basis for refugee protection. Will New Zealand start to incorporate this immediately? Because it seems about time.
Yeah, well, look, this is all under active consideration right now. In fact, Opito Williams-Seo, our Minister for Pacific Peoples, and also Associate Climate Change, and he's got responsibility for, you know, our relationship with the Pacific Islands. And it's a big issue. So he is talking often about, and in fact, the policy work is going on about how we prepare ourselves for some islands that will be, you know, irreversibly affected by climate change.
Yeah.
And we are a natural place to welcome those people and make this their home. So that is under active consideration.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
That was indeed another Andrew Little segment. Moving on to another government decision, what did Generation Zero have to say about the infrastructure announcement, Sam?
So I talked to David Robertson of Generation Zero about how they're slightly disappointed that the government has put the majority of its new funding into roads as opposed to other green infrastructure efforts. Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about what's been happening with the funding of Aotearoa's transport infrastructure recently?
Sure. So with the announcement coming yesterday, we've seen that the majority of transport funding is going to roads, pretty much. I think $1.8 billion is going towards green projects, but 78% of the total amount for transport is going to constructing roads, widening them, and obviously some safety improvements. If I had to add just more on that, our reaction is that it's a kind of a gross misallocation of valuable resources in a time when there's a climate emergency. Why are we spending more money on something that will cause more climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen the Climate Change Response Amendment Act passed recently last year in 2019. And so I imagine that you and the rest of Generation Zero probably expected a different approach to funding of transport infrastructure after that piece of legislation passed.
Definitely. I think we're optimistic. However, yeah, I think this announcement was worse than expected, to be honest.
Can you explain a bit about why it was worse than what you initially expected?
Sure. So the Zero Carbon Bill kind of laid out how New Zealand would reach the Paris Agreement, how it would fulfil the requirements of the Paris Agreement, and that would include halving our emissions by 2030 and then reducing us to carbon neutral, carbon zero by 2050. We were disappointed because we know that building more roads encourages more sprawl, more congestion, more pollution, and worse health overall. which increases our emissions. And every time we increase our emissions, it gets harder to make them peak and then reduce them. The window is closing for us, and yet we're still speeding towards the edge of the cliff.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely something that people definitely feel is a very real and pressing threat. And I think that not only does it have an effect on like our physical health, living in cities which are congested and full of smog and like hard to navigate, but I also think the mental health of young people is a real factor which is often overlooked. And the idea of that we could potentially be dealing with the end times in 30, 40 years.
Exactly. I think we try to stay optimistic at Generation Zero. With all these announcements like this kind of thing, everyone wants to be fiscally conservative. And we know that roads in general are bad economics with their cost-to-benefit ratio. We know they worsen congestion by encouraging more cars and that people are more willing to not be lazy, but take a car over walking or cycling. Probably just the other thing I'd mention that's relevant is that we understand that cars have their place and they're not going away anytime soon. But given the climate emergency, we should be aggressively looking to limit or reduce the number of cars, because the cars that are driving on Tenlink and Mill Road will not be electric cars or electric trucks. They'll be diesel trucks and petrol cars.
So we're talking a bit about compromise here and actually making an active choice to step away from maybe using the car for short journeys or where it's unnecessary. What sort of compromise do you think we could see at a structural level at this point in terms of the way that we look at transport and fund it?
I think for starters, the safety improvements that have to go towards our most dangerous roads are long overdue, and we have obviously no issue with that money being spent responsibly in that area to ensure the safety of all Kiwis. The compromise, so to speak, that's right. When you talked about the majority of trips being quite short, that's absolutely right. I think the majority, 70% of car trips in New Zealand are under 5 kilometres. So they could be quite easily replaced by cycling or walking or public transport. Is there a compromise? I think the majority of spending should be spent on active transport and public transport, with just the bare minimum going towards road improvements, and that's all.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts as to what the eventual consequences of governments not investing in greener transport infrastructure could be?
Sure, absolutely. The biggest one, of course, is just worsening and accelerating our carbon input output, which makes it much harder for us to reach our goals under the Paris Agreement. But it extends beyond the climate, of course. We will pay more on healthcare because more people will drive, so it will be things like crashes, of course, but also obesity as well. We'll pay more in lost productivity because of worse congestion. And of course, things like road maintenance on top of that, given all these heavy cars and soon-to-be electric cars and trucks, we pay a lot of money to reseal these roads, which are just going to be worn down over and over again. So I think those three things, or four things, are the biggest consequences at the front of our minds right now.
Was there anything that you've seen in terms of, I guess, transport funding in other cities or other models that you've seen applied that you think could be applied in Aotearoa's context?
Sure, definitely. I think when we contributed to Auckland's climate action framework underneath our declared climate emergency, we kind of helped outline what the future of the city should look like in 2030 or 2050. And when we look through examples like Vancouver, they say things like, by 2030, 50% of all trips on our roads or kilometres travelled will be by walking, cycling, public transport, and so on. Other things that places like Vancouver and Toronto have done is that from the 90s onwards, they decided that they won't give any more space to private vehicles in the city and only reduce that over time. We think that that will be appropriate as well, and especially in urban centres in New Zealand.
Why do you think that there has been some success in other sectors, such as the decarbonisation of schools and hospitals, but we've been lagging behind a bit when it comes to transport?
I think for that decarbonisation, it's very welcome, but in a way it is kind of a low-hanging fruit. It's long overdue. I think everyone is for it. There's no disagreement. But I think when it comes to transport, it's much more emotionally loaded, because I think everyone is affected by economics and by congestion and that sort of thing. And when we've got this such a car-centric model of life, as we've seen in kind of the Anglosphere for the last half a century, then it's very hard to break this idea that roads cause congestion, they cause climate change, and that we need to change our lifestyles.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add that you think is of pinnacle importance for you right now and for Generation Zero?
Sure. So just to, because this is important, a few things where we think the money could be better spent. We think better improvements or busways out on the northwestern motorway in Auckland and eventually light rail there and to Mangere. We also think that in Wellington, better bus priority measures and high occupancy lanes from the CBD to the airport would be very welcome. And for everywhere in New Zealand, things like cycling infrastructure, because going back to that 5 kilometre rule that we talked about with cars, it's very easy to replace those trips and it's very easy to build cycling infrastructure pretty much in every urban centre in New Zealand. For example, with the $1 billion going towards Mill Road, that could be very easily allocated to link up or to create a comprehensive network of cycling routes in every city in New Zealand instead of just a single road in a single city. If I just had to add one more thing very quickly, it would be that while things like the bus lanes and so on that we might see as like high occupancy veins at Mill Road and that kind of stuff and the cycling infrastructure there, it's very welcome. However, we should ask ourselves, why do we only get critical infrastructure when we're building a new highway? Shouldn't we be doing that actively without having to wait for more cars to come first? That is our main point, I think.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yeah, I think that is a really powerful point that David ended on there. Why is it only when they're building a highway that we get a cycle lane beside it?
Yeah.
Why is it not that we are actually preemptively building these cycle lanes and bus lanes?
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, it's something to think about.
Bro, when I was in Melbourne, there was this guy who, like, rocked up to his bike. And I don't know about you, but, like, when I get on my bike, I'm super gumpy about it. And he just did it so seamlessly, like, got his tote bag, put the lock back in, put the tote bag on like it was a backpack, slid one leg over and just went off. Like, it was so easy.
And probably one of those bike couriers.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was Sam speaking to David Robertson. Let us know your thoughts. 5395 is the number to text, and we'll be back after the break.
Sorry if you're a bike courier out there. That wasn't a dig.
95BFM and Under the Radar welcome back the Schizophonics, the stomping, screaming, funk and roll powerhouse direct from sunny San Diego. Playing February 21st at Lee Sawmill, February 29th at the Yacht Club in Raglan, and March 4th at Neck of the Woods. The Schizophonics Rock and Whirlwind Tour of Aotearoa. Get your tickets now from Under the Radar.
In the market for a cleaner, healthier home? Craft Homes is your first choice. They work with you from design to project completion for a home that's minimum impact, maximum efficiency. Building Homestar 6 homes through to Passive House standard, Craft Homes are smarter, more energy efficient, and built from sustainable and environmentally friendly products. Don't just build a home, build a more sustainable future. Craft Homes. Homestar approved practitioners. Go to crafthomes.co.nz.
You look different.
Oh, cheers, yeah, I got a new haircut.
No, it's not that. Oh. You're like way hotter.
Okay.
And I respect you more. Also, you look smarter and better at sports.
I mean, I got a B card.
That's it! Yup, the B card.
The B card.
The B card.
It's how you win sick prizes. It's how you get incredible discounts. And it's how you help us stay on a platform for awesome out there music, hard hitting news, and the odd bit of cheeky nonsense. Sign up for a B card for just $4.20 a month and support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
It is indeed time for another Neighbourhood Watch. This week, Zoe told me about Australia's coronavirus-related news, and then we talked about Invasion Day, which happened over the weekend just past. How many Australians are at risk at the moment who are in China, and what's ScoMo's plan for them?
So there's a handful, a very small handful that have come back from China who have been diagnosed with this. And it's in the hundreds of people who are currently in China at risk. And ScoMo plans to sort of have an isolation, a quarantine on Christmas Island for these people that are coming back from that region in China. They'll be there for 14 days to isolate themselves. This is a little contentious considering this is Christmas Island and, the facilities there have been used for really awful things. So it is just an interesting place to put people for quarantine before they come back to Australia. The few people that have come back with it, though, it was a very interesting time. I was at work and this man come in, I haven't been reading the news, and he immediately was like, he's just a customer, but have you heard of this virus, blah, 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 it's in Australia, I'm so worried, blah, blah, blah. So he kind of spread a bit of panic very instantly as soon as it came onto the news. There's been a lot of misunderstanding as well, I think, around the virus, but it sent a lot of people into a panic in just the general public because of perhaps some misinformation or the sort of the scandalization of the media that they love to do.
Totally, totally. And has he backed up his decision to choose Christmas Island of all places?
The health minister, Greg Hunt, sort of picked the island because he said it best suited to quickly accommodate people needing to go into quarantine. So it is sort of the quickest, easiest, closest option. I think they're just trying to be really careful about this. And it is a shame because there are still some refugees on Christmas Island, and there is a lot of advocacy groups that are hoping that those families aren't going to be affected in any way. That's still sort of coming out. I mean, this was all announced yesterday about Christmas Island, so the advocacy groups for these families are, saying that they'll be fighting to make sure that they're safe from any quarantine people that are coming home for those 14 days. So, yeah, a little bit of it's just this sort of, it's a shame they're already on a Christmas island and then they have to also deal with this.
And a lot of people in New Zealand and online in the world in general have already sort of jumped on the insensitive bus and used the pandemic as a mechanism for memes and or a basis for being really crude and awful to Asian people. Is there any advocacy from Asian Australians about that experience at the moment?
Do you know what? Not that I've seen personally, but I can't imagine it not happening in Australia, especially. I'd say hopefully not, but if there were, hopefully we are seeing people standing up against that because it is a real shame. And with the history of this country, I wouldn't put it past any sort of really insensitive memes coming out. But nothing that I've seen, but perhaps maybe my social media bubble is very selective.
Totally. Shout out algorithms. I was in Melbourne, as you know, and I went to the Invasion Day protest, and I'm pretty sure it was about 200,000 people around me. How many people attended Invasion Day protests countrywide on Sunday?
Yeah, hundreds and thousands of people across every capital city went out to protest on January the 26th, also known as Invasion Day or Survival Day. So many, especially in Sydney and Melbourne, here in Adelaide at Tandanya, an art gallery, they had a big Survival Day event which thousands of people also attended. Even in London, people gathered at a Captain Cook statue in London as well to show solidarity and support for Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander people. So it's interesting. I was working on January 26th, and I work in the Adelaide CBD, and it just didn't seem... It felt like a shift. It didn't feel like heaps of people were out celebrating January 26th, and it felt a little different this year, just from what I was observing around me. Again, I wasn't near any beaches or anything, though. But, yeah, the theme this year was pay the rent. And that is obvious, I guess, for white Australians, non-Indigenous people, to be paying the rent and paying for their stay here in their country. It seems like these Invasion Day protests are only getting stronger, and more people are really starting to change their minds about January 26th. Not to say there isn't a long way to go, especially within our government, and the fact that the day is still January 26th. So there's contention around obviously changing the day or just abolishing Australia Day altogether. I probably won't comment on that because that's not for me to comment on. But, you know, there's been a lot more talk about change the day or abolish Australia Day or even just recognition of the day being a real day of mourning and celebration of survival for Aboriginal people.
One thing that I picked up on was that sometimes it seemed to come down less to the specificity of dates. It was more the coming together of one grandmother who heads the Melbourne wing of Grandmas Against Removal of Children. She said she had a fire in her belly, and another guy stood up and said, "We're warriors, and this is the beginning." Has there been reception on the part of like Australian politicians that there is a noticeable shift? Because obviously, you know, this has no effect until it translates into policy.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we saw the Labor Party, I think it was the Deputy Labor Party leader, her name is Tanya, and then I always forget her, Tanya Plibersek, I always forget her last name, apologies. Unfortunately, on Australia Day, she came out with this tweet pledging that she would stand for all Australians, and the Labor Party essentially backed their recognition of January 26th being Australia Day. So that was a real shame. She copped a lot of flack for that, and the Labor Party in general as well. It was quite an indirect tweet, but it's a shame because we obviously have our Liberal Party who are happy with January 26th, and moreover from that, not the best policies. But then the Labor Party also recognising January 26th, you know, what does that sort of look like for the future of policies for them in regards to Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander people? We don't really know. Not the best news, but yeah. It is just what sort of first came to mind.
Keep the fire in our bellies alive.
Exactly.
Before we wrap this segment up, I'd like to share one of the speeches that I heard at the protest that I recorded. It does detail violent police force, so switch off now if you think that that may upset you.
And the police came in and they held his family at gunpoint and shot him 3 times. They then dragged him and threw him headfirst into the police wagon, and they locked up the station and locked out all the Aboriginal people at the police station and locked out the police, Aboriginal police officers as well. They locked everyone out.
Shame!
The family were in distress and wanted to see the young Kumujay and see if he was okay because they heard the gunshots.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was another Neighbourhood Watch. We're going to take a break now. We'll lighten the mood a little bit with some Lethal Bizzle, obviously a unreal UK rapper, favourite of mine. And they're bringing the power with a song called Pow.
I'ma get him. Acting on your walk flames on the rhythm. Forward, reload, that's what I'm thinking. And you might see me creep for the hood, chilling. Going like a quick breathing. Women, trying to get a bill, getting money, swimming. I'm Usain Bolt on the rhythm, I'm winning.
Well, well, well. You'll get a punch in the nose like blam. What? You'll get a big nose bleed like blam. How? You'll get a chip on the floor like blam. Yeah, drag the yeah. face across the curb like blam. Yeah, now bring yeah. you in the road like blam. You'll get an elbow drop like well, well, well.
Might be one night. I wonder if I could do that. No telling who's gonna start charting. Drop my new style like would do that. Might be one night. I wonder if I could do that. No telling who's gonna start charting. Drop my new style like would do that. Yeah, I'm lead for the B. I'm the top brand dogs with me. If you don't know about me, yeah, I'm you know. Yeah, I'm lead for the B. I'm the top brand dogs with me. If you don't know about me, yeah, I'm swag blazing. Same way that made whoopsie daisy. Same way getting hit from my waist, man. Same way make them hips go crazy. Still the Grimes and Savior. Back now, just a bit more paper. Think 10 bags at a hater. Sony or not, man's major.
I go harder. My team's moving larger. I got big bars for your whole fam. Make your mum scan cat with your father. I roll deeper. Stylish through the speaker. How can you say it hard? Shout out. You ain't hard either. P. Grammy originator.
I'm old school, I'm from the manor. I'd appear every rave, Imcham MC Shabba. But I was on an original thing, so leave for the middle, please give me 16. I'm selfish, grim knows all about me. Yeah, I'm on a money man, it's all about cheese. And I don't mean the wine when I'm dining. Oh, snap, I couldn't give a flying in the whole hood, never like, am I writing? Cause I'm a hood like Little Red Riding. Oh, what big balls you have? Murder, man, in a no pen. If you this K.A., your skin burn, man.
Yeah, I'm lead for the B. I'm the top brand dogs with me. If you don't know about me, yeah, I'm you know. Yeah, I'm lead for the B. I'm the top brand dogs with me. If you don't know about me, yeah, I'm
it's lead for the record. Grime 2011. We run the ish.
Kicking off the Silo sessions for 2020, the Phoenix Foundation will perform their one and only Auckland Summer Show for free at Silo Park, Sunday, 2nd of Feb.
Well, it's all that I wanted, you know.
Don't miss one of New Zealand's most accomplished acts performing their classics as well as new songs from the upcoming album. A day of live music, food trucks and drinks from the Silo Bar. The Phoenix Foundation with support from Harvey Unclear and Skeela at Silo Park, Sunday 2nd of Feb from 12 p.m. For full info, go to silopark.co.nz.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words. Because he waka eke noa, tu whitia te hopo. Get over your fears and just do it.
So, I was thinking about asking a girl on a date.
Tōwhiti a te hopo, what's the worst that could happen?
Okay, Do you want to go on a date with me?
Get over your fears and just do it. Tu fitia te hopo. Māori words. Karawhiua. Give it a go.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Welcome back to The Wire. You guys are talking about onions in this next story.
Yeah, and former Prime Minister of the place they call Australia, Tony Abbott's appreciation of onions is mentioned in there. But no, I had a yarn with AUT Professor Elaine Rush about how foodstuffs, our export and import system, adversely affects the most disadvantaged communities within Aotearoa. So, yeah, world first piece of research, looking at import-export patterns and how that affects people living in poverty.
Just to begin with, can you give me a bit of background on the kinds of foods New Zealand tends to export versus the types of foods we tend to import?
Well, our biggest export is dairy, and by dairy I don't include butter, but milk and cheese. And we export enough every day over each year to feed 39 million people. That's a lot of milk and cheese.
It certainly is a lot of milk and cheese.
And then we export enough meat, that's beef and lamb, seafood and other proteins, which is just a small part of that, to feed 11.5 million people. So that's more than twice the New Zealand population. That's the required, recommended 2.5 servings a day. We only export enough to feed 2 million people vegetables, and a lot of that is actually onions. We're a great exporter of the onions in the world. But then we also export enough fruit, which is mainly kiwi fruit and apples, to feed 10 million people, two servings every day of the year.
Wow. I mean, like, onions aren't really too much good for anyone except unless you're perhaps the former Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott.
Yeah, but, you know, they do have their worth, and they add flavour and taste. And we do need to eat a variety of vegetables and fruit each day, and we do grow that in New Zealand, but we're not eating them.
So what's happening? What kind of foods are we eating, or what kind of foods are we left with?
Just an example, yesterday, wasn't it, that the New Zealand market's been flooded with crayfish because we can't send them to China? And suddenly crayfish are cheap for New Zealand people. Not that I've seen any, but, you know, that's the way it works, is that we export our best to get the money, and the prices for the New Zealand people usually follow what we're getting for export. Hmm. So there's an imbalance there as well. So, yeah. But what we're importing is a huge amount of sugar, enough to feed 300 grams to each New Zealand per day.
Lord.
That's a lot of sugar, isn't it?
That is a
that,
lot.
That's what we're importing.
So your statistics show that around 40% of adults and 20% of children live in households where food insecurity is a factor. What is food insecurity exactly, and what factors drive it?
Those statistics actually come from the Ministry of Health and the National Health Surveys. So the questions they ask are things like, are you able to buy the foods that you want? Do you ever not buy food because you don't have enough money? So the main driver is poverty, because usually most of the food of the income of a household goes on rent and other essentials, and food takes a second place, and so often it's the cheaper, maybe more short-term filling foods that are bought rather than the quality, nutritious foods, the vegetables and fruits, the whole grains, the dairy and the quality sources of protein that our Ministry of Health recommends.
Hmm. So if we are exporting a high proportion of our nutrient-rich foodstuffs and charging a premium for them in the domestic market, and then importing nutrient-poor foods, which are sold cheaper, what impacts are we likely to see, and who is going to feel them?
Well, we've seen it already. I would argue that New Zealand is one of the most malnourished countries in the world. Now, there's different types of malnutrition. So there's obesity, which is long-term, too many calories, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have all the vitamins and minerals and the protein that you need. There's undernutrition, which is maybe you're small for your size, but also there is undernutrition when you don't have those vitamins and minerals. So you often call that hidden hunger. And then there's the food insecurity, the food poverty that we're talking about. And so there's huge numbers of people in New Zealand in that situation. And if you're not fed well, you don't go well. It's like a car. If you put rubbish petrol in, you're not going to be able to speed down the road. And we're in that situation. We're not fueling our bodies with all the secret ingredients that they need. Well, not so secret really, but yeah.
So if we do have the means to feed our population, but there is a strong financial incentive to export those foodstuffs, how do we then shift the focus to increasing local access to quality food?
Well, there's a number of things I think we should be debating. I don't say they will solve the problem because it's a really difficult one. We should be looking at making fruit, vegetables and fruit more accessible, and that can include reducing the price. And I know we don't have subsidies in our system, which helps with free trade, but it does mean the prices go up. So maybe GST could come off, or we could be giving out food vouchers specifically for vegetables and fruit, minimally processed ones, because frozen and tinned are really good too. You can't always get fresh every day. There seems to be so many layers in the food market where it goes through from the grower, who's not actually getting a lot of money for it, through to taking it to the factory, the processing there, the processing. At each step, everyone puts their markup on. So at the end, the food can be about cost five times more than the actual ingredients. So it does keep people employed, but sometimes food travels far further than it should. And you know, we have in New Zealand really good land where vegetables and fruit can be grown well. Is there some way we could look at distributing it more equitably?
Absolutely.
We all need to work together on it.
Well, what I'm interested in also is we have a lot of land tied up in beef and dairy production and a lot of money invested in infrastructure to support that. These are foodstuffs which the forecast for them is that they're going to become more environmentally unsustainable over time, which in turn may even drive up prices more or like result in other detrimental effects societally. Do you see that as being an issue or like having any sort of ramifications for people in Aotearoa?
It does. We're in a situation with global warming, climate change, inequity in our society, where the gap between the rich and the poor is getting wider, where we have to look at this all very seriously from many points of view. Now, the land that supports beef and lamb in New Zealand isn't necessarily suitable for growing vegetables. In fact, only about 2% of our land is used to grow vegetables at the moment, so very productive. But we do need to think very carefully about what we contribute both to New Zealand and also to the world, because there's some countries like China and Singapore that cannot produce enough food for their population. So in the spirit of global unity and us all behaving as human beings rather than keeping our own, we need to consider this problem from all different angles. But I would argue that unless we can get New Zealanders healthier and more productive by feeding them better, we're not going to be able to play our part in the world of the future and make it more secure for our children. And part of that will be eating more plant foods, eating more fibre, which is one of the things that we're very poor on in New Zealand, not enough whole grains or vegetables. Fibre only comes from plants, and that's long-term what helps prevent bowel cancer, which is one of the big cancer killers in New Zealand. We need to just get some more balance into the system and feed New Zealand first and look after all New Zealanders.
Well, Elaine, I'm getting towards the end of my allocated studio time, but I would just like to ask, is there anything that you think is really important for the listener to know, for us out there to know?
But we don't know these things unless we measure them, and we need to look at it closely and have our facts. What I'd like your listeners to do is to get out there and challenge their local politicians, particularly as they're looking towards an election, about what they are going to do to help feed all New Zealanders better, because I think that's one of our biggest problems that we have at the moment in New Zealand, is that we are malnourished and we're not getting the full potential out of all our wonderful people we have.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for another Thursday. Thank you to everyone that we had on the show today. We had Justice Minister Andrew Little, Zoe Canandas from Radio Adelaide, David Robertson, and Professor Elaine Rush. Some food for thought. Food for food and food for thought on that last
and hopefully
piece.
Some more food in the bellies of New Zealanders.
Of everyone who needs it. We will catch you next week. Are you here next week? Am I moving back to Tuesday next week? I don't know.
I don't know.
I have no idea what I'm doing.
I'm here
life.
Next week.
Stay hydrated. Eat your fibre. Ka kite anō.
A big shotties and a Schlatter bowl.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.